Everyone, welcome to Grand Rounds. This is a special Grand Rounds for us because we have a guest speaker, Dr. Jean Maraganore, who is one of our stars in the field of movement disorders, but we recognize that is also the reason he's going to prove his stardom in a second act is because he's been here developing a strategy to doing research with the resources that we'll have. In EPIC, but particularly his area of expertise as I grew up in movement disorders was in neurogenetics. And so Jim was someone I read papers from because he was very influential. He's been very influential in the field, and it's always quite interesting to me that anyone could extend the reaches of an earlier career into well beyond what the original intent what one thinks may have been. So it's fascinating to see Jim again creating a mark in the field in an area that perhaps wouldn't have been intuitive had we thought about the different genes that he was discovering for Parkinson's and other conditions. So we're very delighted to have you and very intrigued about your ideas on how to incorporate EPIC into research. Thank you so much for coming.
We have a fabulous Department of Neurology here. Joe Broderick and I were residents together. In fact, he was a senior resident, and I always looked up to him because he's such an outstanding individual. And I had the opportunity to meet Brett also on study section, and Dr. Quinlan, John Quinlan, I think he's still in your department. He was a senior resident when I was training, and he was like the best big brother you could possibly have. So you have really a fabulous group here, and it's really an honor. And Joe Matsumoto, my dear colleague for many years at Mayo, had been on the faculty here too. So this is a great place, and you should all be proud to work here. I'm going to be talking about quality improvement in practice-based research in neurology using the electronic medical record. Just a quick question. Who in this room considers themselves a clinician? Raise your hands. Okay. And who in this room considers themselves an informaticist or an IT person? Any of those people here? And one good, excellent. Well, you're my best friend where I work. And who in this room considers themselves a genomicist? Okay. So why talk about genomics when we can be talking about clinomics? Wouldn't that be a lot more exciting and interesting? And so that's kind of the epiphany I had in the middle of my career, is here I am, you know, being the, you know, the phlebotomist for these high-maintenance geneticists, you know, and I'm all these fancy exams, and all they care about is case, not case. And I thought, boy, you know, is that what you do with your career in neurology? And, you know, where are all these small little genetic signals and discoveries truly taking the field? And so when I went to North Shore, we have a really great electronic medical record and a really great IT team. And I thought, well, why not build our department's strengths around corporate infrastructural strengths in informatics? And since we're all clinicians, why don't we just do what we're good at? So I think that's kind of a little bit of a prelude to how I stumbled into this subject area, and I think that background may give it some appeal to some of you here also. Just by way of conflict of interest, we got a grant to support this work from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality in R01 last summer, and we also had some generous philanthropic support for the, yes, I'm still doing genomics part of this endeavor, and I'll briefly talk about that too. But I'm really most excited about the clinomic or the clinical aspect of this. So, you know, I'm the chair of neurology at a community-based health system. We have four hospitals, 2,000 employed physicians. Neurology has 40 employed physicians. We have an additional 100 staff. And our vision is to be the preeminent providers of neurological care in Chicagoland. We don't want to be the world's destination for neurology. We don't want to have the most NIH grants. We don't want to have the best residency program or the best fellowships. We want you to have those, and we want to hire your graduates. But we want to be the best at taking care of patients in this little place where we live called Chicago. So what we basically are good at is taking care of patients. And because we're in a large community, we have a large local loyal recurring patient population. we see people again and again and again. But we don't take care of these patients in a standardized way. I defined Parkinson's disease this way. You define it slightly differently. Are we talking about the same condition even? And then, you know, I ask these questions. You ask those questions. We overlap this much, but not entirely. We both ask about family history of Parkinson's disease or tremor, but what do you mean by family history? Do you mean any relative in any generation? Do you mean at least one first degree relative? Do you mean at least two relatives in two generations? So there's a total lack of standardization in clinical practice. And do I do better as a doctor than you do? Because our patients care about that. And how can we begin to measure how we are caring for our patients and what their outcomes are and what factors account for that variability? And that's clinical practice today. Total chaos, okay? And so we decided, well, look, let's take out the variability, because by taking out variability, the belief is, industry has shown, you can improve outcomes. So the first step was to develop standardization and structure, and we decided to do that through the EMR. So we got together and we said, name a disorder, any subspecialty group in the room, name a disorder that is prevalent, progressive, variable, unpredictable, unpreventable. Well, that's all of neurology, right? But you name your favorite prevalent, progressive, variable neurological disease. Question number one, how will you define it? You have to all agree. How are we going to define it? Sounds like a stupid question, but you'd be surprised how much discussion you can have around that with a group of subspecialty neurologists. Now that you've defined the disorder, your cohort, who's in, who's not in your cohort, what are the outcomes that matter to you? And what are the outcomes that matter to your patients? Forget about what outcomes matter to the Michael J. Fox Foundation, or what matters to the genomicist, or what matters to the NIH study section. What outcomes matter to you and to your patients? Okay. Third question, what's the best way of measuring those outcomes in a clinical practice setting? You know, if it's a 39-question Parkinson's disease quality of life questionnaire, good luck with that one. You know, in a 60-minute office visit, I don't think so. What's the best way of measuring those outcomes? And do you even have permission to use those measures? Who in this room uses the mini mental state examination? Okay. Do you have a license? Are you paying $1 every time you use it or whatever the fee is? Who in this room uses the MoCA? Okay. That's what I was using. Do you know that you're violating, do you put it into Epic? Okay, do you know that that's not allowed? We found that out, interestingly enough. The people, the Mocha Inc. people who got all of us to use it because the mini mental was bad, and they're good, and they made it into 85 languages, and here it is, it's one pretty little page. Now they've decided that there's only going to be one electronic version of the Mocha. You can't even recreate it in Excel as a spreadsheet, and they're going to create it and wait for us. It's coming soon. And you know what they're going to do. They're going to try to sell it to EMRs, and if they don't buy it, they're not going to let them use it. So how can you measure the outcomes? And do you have permission to use those measures in the EMR? And now that you've defined your dependent variables, your Ys, what are the Xs? What factors X predict the outcome Y? What are the independent variables? And how do you measure those things? So once you define the cohort, the outcomes, the measures, and the covariates, now you can start to talk in a standardized way about what would be, in 60 minutes, the best you can do. And who's on the team? And what are their assignments? And how will we navigate that care? So what does a medical assistant do? What does a nurse do? What does a PA or an APN do? What does a student or a resident or fellow do? What does the neurologist, you know, the God on Olympus get to do, okay? Hopefully nothing but pontificate. But all kidding aside, then you could talk about how do we navigate this care. But the order in which you do the job and you collect the data is not necessarily how you want it to write to the note. If you've got the MA starting out with doing some drug reconciliation and allergies and social history, we don't write notes where that goes to the top, right? So now you have to remap things. So once you've defined who's in the cohort, the outcomes, the measures, the covariates, you've decided who's on the care team, you decide what's the workflow in which you'll collect the information, how you map it to the note, then the next step is we meet with Epic Builders. And we have about a dozen people in our organization who do nothing but customize Epic and build discrete tools into Epic, customized navigators, documentation flow sheets, smart forms with smart data elements that cascade open or closed depending on what you click. And what's great about these tools is that, number one, they standardize care according to our best practices. They may not be the best practices. We'll find out with time. But they standardize care according to our best practices, number one. Number two, instead of typing a note like this or typing a note like this or dictating War and Peace like this that no one reads, by the way, you can sit there with a structured form and it asks you all the right questions and you can be a monkey and be a pretty good neurologist. All you have to do is ask the questions and faithfully document what the patient is telling you. Of course, interpreting it all is another story, but at least documenting the information is pretty straightforward. Every mouse click writes lines or paragraphs or tables of perfectly spelt, perfectly paginated text to your progress note. I can write a 10-page progress note with up to 1,000 discrete fields of information in an office visit just with my mouse and get a level 5 billing reimbursement. And every click of that mouse captures data in real time that can be analyzed. So every office visit is basically a research quality encounter. And so it's very efficient. So that's building structured clinical documentation support, or SCDS. The next step is to say, okay, we've built the tools, but are we using them? Because we've spent a lot of money building these tools. I spend about $25,000 a month on informatics charge outs. So as you can imagine, I want to make sure people are using the tools. So are we using the tools? And what are the characteristics of the patient population? How many men, how many women, how many Hispanics, non-Hispanics, how many Caucasians, Asians, African-Americans, et cetera? I'll never have to worry about creating that table for NIH again. We do it automatically. We can look at how often we're seeing people from month to month. Are there trends from year to year? We can look to see when we're enrolling people in research, how well are we enrolling them? What are the participation rates? What are the follow-up rates? Because we like to see people as part of our best practices at least annually. So this is information that clinicians normally don't have at their fingertips. Deans have this information, VPs have this information, chairmen perhaps, but certainly not clinicians in the front lines. And these tools make that possible. So now we know we're using the tools, but are we using them well? And one of my favorite quotes, which I'm going to butcher, is from Sir Josiah Stamp. He was a bureaucrat in England in the early 20th century. And he said, the government are good at amassing statistics. They add them, raise them to the nth power, and take the square root. They make wonderful diagrams and figures. But in the end, it boils down to the village watchman who puts down what he damn pleases. So we're all the village watchmen. And when we're seeing patients, we put down what we damn please. And what is the quality of the data collection? Are we collecting sushi-grade data? Because it's only through the sushi-grade data that we're going to truly learn something about variability in neurology. So we get together with clinicians and we say, in this toolkit that you've built, what data elements are always required? Every time you see a patient, you're going to do this. You're going to do it at the initial visit, and you're going to do it at least annually. And we all agree on what the required fields are. And every month, they get a data quality report. And it tells them by patient, by encounter, by field, what was missing. The neurologist has the opportunity to ignore it, but then they're collecting bad data. You know, shame on you. The neurologist has the opportunity to impute the missing information from somewhere else in the record where it's somewhat duplicated. We could ask a nurse to call and recollect the information if it's historical, or it goes missing. But typically what happens is the records are about 6 months in arrear until we can get them into production. And you get your report, it's about this thick, and you have a migraine. And then the next month we run the report, and guess what? It's this thick. And then the next month we run the report, and guess what? There's no report. Because the neurologists have all learned how to use the tools faithfully. And so we are collecting sushi-grade data. So the next step is to say, okay, we've got great data. We've done this 100-plus times. Are there some patterns that we can start to observe? What are the medians and the ranges for continuous trait variables? For categorical variables, what are the frequencies of A versus B versus C? And we can begin to see patterns. Let me ask a question in the group. You all use the MoCA. What percentage, and if I tell you that the median disease duration of Parkinson patients when they come to my clinic are 3 years, median disease duration. So what percentage of patients do you think on the MoCA at the first visit score less than 26, which is consistent with cognitive impairment? Does anyone want to throw out a number? Within 3 years of Parkinson seeing onset.
40%.
What did you say?
40,
15? Huh? 20? 60%. 60%. We are under-detecting vulnerability in our Parkinson patient populations. Who's talking to them about their stock options? Who's talking to them about advanced care planning? Who's talking to them about or evaluating their driving safety? Who's talking to them about power of attorney? We're ignoring that. Okay. Similarly, you might look at your records and say, what percentage of our patients fell in the last year? And of those, who had physical therapy and who didn't? Are we leaving our patients vulnerable to hip fractures, subdurals, because we're not actively detecting and managing their falls? And those are the things that the EMR can see in the descriptive cohort report. And by looking at frequencies, you start to say, oh my goodness, there's a gap here. We can address this gap through some sort of a quality improvement project. So the next step is to say, okay, let's do QI. How many times did a patient have a MoCA less than 26 and we didn't send them for neuropsych testing, or we didn't administer advanced care planning? How many times did a patient report falling in the last year and they hadn't seen physical therapy or an order wasn't placed at the office visit? And how many times did a patient screen positive for depression on a validated short screen for depression and we didn't prescribe an antidepressant or send them to psychiatry or to a social worker or at least document why we weren't doing that? Okay? And these are things that in neurology are commonly overlooked. So we could develop a number of quality improvement projects. But this is the beauty of the EMR. Why be so passive about it? Why let a report tell you how good or bad you're doing? The computer knows at the point of care if your patient is at risk, and the computer can alert you. So the computer sees that the patient fell within the last year, has not seen a physical therapist in the last year, and as you're going to close the encounter, has not had a physical therapy order placed. When you go to close the encounter, a non-intrusive BPA can pop up and say, Jim, your patient's at risk for falls. Would you like to place a physical therapy order? If you click yes, the order's automatically placed. If you say no, just no worries. Just give me a reason from this drop-down menu. Patient's going to do it elsewhere. Patient's in the donut hole with insurance, whatever the case may be. But you can document that, and we can begin to learn. And so we can hardwire quality and safety through the EMR. Only if you have discrete information. What's discrete in the EMR today? Nothing useful to a neurologist. It's useful to the federal government and CMS. It's useful to the health system. We know about billing. We know about diagnoses. We know about meds. But we don't know about the things that neurologists need to know about discreetly. And so we can't wire the computer to help us practice better. We can take it even another step. We have a problem in neurology. We have multiple FDA-approved or mainstreamed treatments for a given indication, and we have no knowledge of what's better. Is drug A or B or C better? I use drug A because I'm an old-timer and it was around when I trained. Dr. Espe uses drug B because he's a modern man and he keeps up with the literature. Someone else uses drug C because he has a conflict of interest. Okay, so A, B, or C, we all have our own favorite drug for this problem or that problem or the other problem. There's no equipoise. There's no knowledge about superiority. When you get a drug approved by the FDA, all you have to determine is this drug non-inferior to something else that's approved for this indication? And is it reasonably safe? Okay? It doesn't ask you to show, is this drug superior and for which subgroups of patients? So now you go to the NIH and you say, I got a great idea. I'm going to compare three FDA-approved commonly employed drugs for a common neurological condition. And the study section laughs at you, and they say, dude, this is incremental. You know, bring back your mouse model, then we could have a conversation. You know, but we're not interested in this phase four stuff that you're doing, okay? So you go to the drug company, and you say, hey, drug company, I got a great idea. I think your drug is going to be better for only some patients. Should we do a trial to see if your drug is better for only some patients and which one? And they laugh and say, Dr. Mariganori, we'll send our drug rep to you who will kindly explain to you that our drug is the best for all patients. You know, and so there's really no way of finding out which are the superior drugs and for which patients. Let me give you a real story. Board member at my organization, they have a habit of calling the chairman to find out who's the best doctor to see this or that or to get curbside consultations. The apple of her eye is at Duke. Good school, undergraduate, wants to go into medicine. Kids at Duke, he's got migraine. He gets stressed out in his first quarter, can't take all the pressure. He starts having frequent migraines. He sees a neurologist there, dumps him on some, probably an advanced practice nurse, puts him on a preventive, doesn't work. Okay, weeks pass, still having a lot of headaches. Now he can't take it anymore, he drops out of Duke. Moves back home, goes to Lake Forest College, good, you know, small college in the suburbs of Chicago, you know, nothing wrong with Lake Forest College, but it isn't Duke, you know, but he's living close to home. So now he sees one of my neurologists. My neurologist says, no problem, we're going to put you on this preventive. Weeks pass, escalate the dose, doesn't work, okay? Now, out of desperation, the neurologist says, we got to do something, because now he's dropping out of Lake Forest College. I'll give him a Medrol pack. What's the evidence for that? Gives him the Medrol pack. He gets the shingles, outburst. And what does the kid do now? He's going to EMT school, okay? Finally got him on a drug that prevents his migraine, but at what cost to the individual? We have to individualize medicine, and we can't individualize medicine until we can measure features about our patients that make them distinct individuals, and until we can have a structured way of capturing and discerning which drugs work best for which patients. And we could do that in the EMR. So what we've built in the EMR is a tool called SUBA, Subgroup-Based Adaptive Assignments. And what SUBA does is initially, if there's no prior evidence as to which drug is better, A, B, or C, it randomizes the patient. When we see the patient in the office, they say, your patient is eligible for preventive. Would you like for SUBA to recommend which drug to take? It's just a recommendation. You say to the patient, hey, do you mind if I use the computer to help guide me in giving you the best treatment? What patient is going to say, nope, I only want to do it old school, Dr. Mariganori. You know, don't use the computer. Don't want any computational knowledge here. You know, so of course the patient says yes, and you mark click. The patient verbally consents to use the computer for assignment. You say assign, the cherry wheel spin, and if there's no prior knowledge about which is the best drug for this particular type of patient, the computer says A. The next time it says B. The next time it says C. It creates equipoise. After about 100 of these randomized assignments, SUBA can begin, based on the independent variables that you use as the inputs, you can start to see subgroup effects. Look at this. Women, when you put them on A, have a high likelihood of stopping the drug within 6 months. So the next time a woman comes along, you don't randomly assign them to A, B, or C. You put them on B, C, B, C, B, C. Now that you've run your trial for a year or so through the EMR, and the EMR says, look at this. Women always do better on C. So the next time you see a woman, you put her on C. Maybe men under the age of 50 do great on B, and maybe geriatric patients do well on A. And so by using the computer and the discrete data we collect, we can begin to do pragmatic trials using the EMR, and it's actually precision medicine at the point of care. That's, I think, what we need to offer to our patients, not this guesswork that we do. Okay. So now you've built these great tools. You've taken 5 years to do it, as we've had. You've spent about $500,000 in informatics charge-outs alone. Forget about all the time that the neurologist put into meeting every 2 weeks and building these tools and so forth. Now what do you do? Well, now what you do is you give it away for free. That's what any respectable gentleman would do. You give it away for free to anybody who's willing to use it. And if and you say, look, you're quid pro quo. I don't have the rights to install things in your EMR after all. I'm not a computer outsource company. So we'll give you these tools. We have an implementation manager. She will sit there hand by hand with your HIT people and walk them through every step of the installation. We expect maximum 100 hours to install 11 toolkits that we've built that capture up to 1,000 fields of data each. And all we ask is that you share your de-identified data. Don't want to see anything that identifies the patient. And oh, by the way, we will share in our de-identified data. And oh, by the way, we will federate the database. I don't own it. We own it. We will decide what projects we want to do, what papers we want to write, what grants we want to write. We'll have a governance. Okay? And we create a neurology practice-based research network. To my knowledge, this is the first ever neurology practice-based research network using the EMR. I'll talk a little bit about Axon Registry at the end if we have time, which is the AAN initiative. But this is a distinct but complementary approach. And then finally, what's the icing on the cake? You've collected all of this great data repeatedly over time. Looks like cohort studies to me. And you can begin to correlate genomics and all sorts of biomarkers to outcomes as well if you want to get fancy. And this creates a great infrastructure for research as well. So what's the three-legged stool of quality improvement? Structure, processes, outcomes. The biggest impediment to improving quality is that you don't have the structures. We've created the structure. The second biggest impediment is you don't have processes in place to improve quality. We've created the processes. And the third big impediment is you can't measure the outcomes. We measure the outcomes. Quality improvement, practice-based research in neurology using the EMR. So where are we? Okay. Well, if I had chosen to have less than 4 hours of sleep last night, we would have been at stage 6 for all of these disorders. Okay, so these are the 7 chakras of quality improvement. Chakra 1, you know, everything important has to be either 12s, like the 12 steps or the 12 disciples, or 7, like, you know, if you're from the Eastern tradition. So these are my 7 chakras. So step 1, structured clinical documentation support. Stage 2, enrollment reports. Stage 3, data quality reports. Stage 4, descriptive cohort reports. Stage 5, quality improvement dashboards. By the way, our dashboards are pivot tables that we've integrated with the EMR. I can look by provider, by patient age, by gender, by practice site. How are we doing on average 5 quality improvement measures per disorder? So we're running about 55 quality improvement projects in the department right now. And we can get so granular as to say, how am I doing on this measure when I'm practicing at this site with young women? And so that's something that we can do with quality improvement dashboard. The SUBA, the clinical decision support, our first BPA, which is if the patient screens positive for depression or anxiety, are we managing their mental health disorder by either prescribing something or referring them to somebody? That literally, I have to sign off on the product, and it'll be in production by the end of the week. And then disseminating in the neurology practice-based research network, we have 7 sites: Dartmouth, University of Pennsylvania, Medical University of South Carolina, Wake Forest, Ochsner Health System, University of Arkansas, University of Nebraska, who are all in the process of installing our tools, and we will have the first tools installed at Wake Forest and Ochsner in February. So in 5 years, this is kind of where we are. It's been a process, a stepwise process. We can implement from scratch about 3 projects a year. It costs us about $25,000 a month in charge outs, but were you to participate, you could implement 11 projects in 1 year, it would cost you about $10,000, about the equivalent of 100 hours of IT programmer analyst. So that's a pretty good deal, I think. I'm not totally abandoning my past, although I'm trying the best I can. And we have a project that we call the DDoNA project, DNA predictions to improve neurological health. DDoNA is a metaphor. The oldest oracle of ancient Greece was in the Valley of DDoNA. If you read the Iliad and the Odyssey, they don't go to Delphi. That's where the tourist bus go to Greece today. That was the oracle of classical Greece. The oracle of archaic Greece was in DDoNA. Odysseus went there. He should have listened and not angered Poseidon by blinding his son Polyphemus. He spent a lot of extra years at sea. Achilles went there. He should have listened and not go to war. He wasn't as immortal as he thought. Medea forgot to dip his ankle into the elixir of immortality, and so forth. But what happened at Dodona was priestesses would sit under a sacred oak tree. The wind would blow through the valley, and the leaves would rustle. And they would interpret the subtle variations in the oak leaves. And based on their interpretations of subtle variations, they would predict the future and advise leaders of correct actions to take. So by metaphor, we can interpret subtle variations in DNA from Dodona, isn't that cute? The sacred tree of life, to predict medical outcomes and to individualize the care of patients. So what have we done? Well, we've built these 11 cohorts at the point of care. We hardly even knew we were doing cohort studies. We just thought we were taking care of patients with really cool tools that make it easier to write great notes. But we're when we have about 1,000 patients per cohort, we're kind of at genome-wide power. That's kind of entry-level power. So we're collecting 11 cohorts, 1,000 subjects per cohort. We can capture up to 1,000 discrete fields of data per office visit. Thank God not every field cascades open, because we don't select every cascading variable after all, but we certainly select several hundred fields of data per office visit. And we're gonna follow these people for a median 10 years of follow-up, because I figure I'm gonna retire in about 20 years, and I need at least 10 years to make sense of all of this. So you can do all the person years. I think that adds up to 110,000 person years, and it adds up to 11 million, I think, fields of data. And then, oh, by the way, we're collecting DNA. And we have, when we go to close the chart, a BPA fires, best practice alert, says, Jim, your patient's eligible to be enrolled in the biobank. Would you like to enroll them in the biobank? Sure, I'd like to enroll them in the biobank. When I click that button and say yes, a message goes out to the medical assistant. They grab the consent form and the blood draw kit, and they're coming in on my heels. And they're consenting the patient. When we can enroll patients at the point of care into a biobank, can anyone guess what the participation rate is? What do you think the participation rate was of eligible PPMI patients? Above 8. 97%. 97% participation rate at the point of when you enroll people at the point of care. Okay, so that's what we're doing. And basically, we're creating the field of clinomics. Forget genomics. That's for self-important people with genotyping platforms that a monkey could run. I think James Watson said that once about sequencers. But a monkey can't be a clinician, and we're not monkeys. So this is taking advantage of our strength, which is our ability to evaluate patients and to capture great data. Where are we in the endeavor? We're making good progress. We have about 550 Parkinson patients collected. We have up to 5 years of follow-up for some of those people. We have 700 and nearly 750 migraine patients, more than 200 MS, more than 300 RLS, 200 epilepsy, more than 250 memory patients. And this project started a year ago. We have brain tumor patients. We just started a concussion cohort. We just started our stroke cohort in the fall. We have nearly 100 patients already enrolled. These are secondary prevention of ischemic stroke. That's the focus of that outpatient activity. And then we've even created a center for brain health, which I'll talk about in the next hour. We want to change the paradigm of neurology from brain diseases to brain health. And instead of kind of waiting and waiting and waiting for someone to get Alzheimer's and shrugging our shoulders and saying, well, it's a bad disease, we got Aricept, nothing seems to work, we actually recognize that there are 20 modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. And by simply modifying them, we can cut the rate of the disease by 50%. So we're enrolling people at risk for Alzheimer's disease into a brain health cohort to identify their modifiable risk factors and to give them an opportunity to live brain healthy for the rest of their life. So that's the other cohort. And then our neuropathy cohort, we're opening up in March. So we've already got 2,600 patients in the cohort. I've genotyped them all for 1 million SNPs. You can genotype 1 million SNP genotypes on a Affymetrix platform for $74. If you send a blood sample out to Athena Diagnostics for an ApoE test, it costs you $500. That's shameful. When they're done with Shkreli, they should put the Athena people on the stand in front of Congress. But for $74, you can get a million genotypes, including APOE. Okay. So let's talk briefly about the structure. I'm, as always, running late, so I'm going to just give you a quick teaser of what these tools look like. I'm going to come here and bring up EPIC, which undoubtedly has timed out on me by now. Yep. I'll just quickly log back on into the, this is in the dev environment, so don't worry, we're not violating HIPAA. Okay. And I'm going to find a patient here that is called Cincinnati Live, because this is a lively town and a lively group. There it is. People are already working at work, that's good to see. And I'm going to open up this encounter here. So you're all on EPIC, right? Are you using the 2014 version of it probably? Okay, so this is kind of probably what it looks like. This is a meaningful use navigator. It's good for an orthopod, it's good for a neurologist, it's good for a podiatrist, it's good for a dermatologist. It's good for meeting meaningful use. It's good for the FPA to collect data and to maximize your reimbursement, all important things. But it's not that great for neurologists. Chief complaint, that's not even discrete. Vitals are discrete, whoopee-doo, unless you're a stroke doctor. Allergies, medications, that's discrete. That's a good independent variable, but what about the outcome variables? The progress note, that's all alphanumeric gobbledygook, means nothing to a computer. Forget about natural language processing, it's never going to happen. Visit diagnoses, they're discrete. So that's what you get. That doesn't look like a very powerful tool for doing research at the point of care. So we built these customized navigators. And let's just pick the Parkinsonism one, because I think people would be disappointed if I didn't even mention Parkinson's once in this lecture. So, oh, I picked the neuropathy one by accident. So we'll come back here to Parkinsonism. Let me see what I'm doing here. Okay. So, you know, we've made some, someone in dev has done something weird. Those are the neuropathy chief complaints, so we'll just ignore those. Let's come to this field here. This, first of all, what you see is the navigator has grown. Okay, so it's no longer this short little navigator. The office visit hasn't grown. It's still 60 minutes. But the navigator has grown because we've made the activities discrete. The second thing you'll notice is that we've defined who's on the care team, the medical assistants, the nurses, and the physicians. Okay, and they all know what their job is. And their job is to collect all the information as they agreed to. What type of a visit is it? Initial visit. Oh, look at this. It cascades open to a bunch of questions that you're going to ask at the initial visit, but maybe not again. What's the patient's ethnicity? Let's say they're Greek, G-R-E-E. It's smart. That could be one of those three things. And let's say they're also Italian. It's smart. It knows that, that can only be Italy. Have you ever lived on a farm for a year or longer? That's a risk factor for Parkinson's disease. If yes, it cascades open in the past or present for how many years? So we can get a little bit of a cumulative dose exposure. Are you currently driving? This is a quality of life measure. If you go to the AAN quality guidelines, you have to once a year review driving safety with your patients with Parkinson's. Are you doing it? Are you documenting it? And how well are you doing it? So we ask about driving safety, and we have these eight questions. Have you had a car accident in the last year? No. Moving violation? No. Gotten lost driving in familiar places? No. Had your driving safety tested? Yes. Did they say that you had to restrict your driving? No. Have other people felt you're an unsafe driver? Always my wife. Do you feel you're an unsafe driver? Absolutely not. And then we could, again, the MA is just asking things that the MA can ask. They're not necessarily in a logical order. We're going to map it to the nonological order. Now, again, she comes to habits. We ask in EPIC routinely about smoking and alcohol, but not about caffeine. That's important for Parkinson's. Have you ever been a coffee drinker? Yes or no? If yes, which one? I drink coffee in the past or in the present. We can put how many cups a day, 4 cups. For how many years, 40 years, it'll calculate your cup years of coffee drinking. Mine are probably higher, truth be told. Have you ever taken pesticides or not? That's a risk factor for Parkinson's, if yes or no, in the past, occupational. You're getting the idea. What about protective drugs? Have you ever used a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory? Yes. These are all the commonly used nonsteroidals in our practice, both generic and non-generic. Let's say I took aspirin for 6 months or longer. Have you ever taken a statin drug? Let's just say that I took Crestor in the past. Have you ever had a head injury with loss of consciousness? I am the official neurologist of the Chicago Bears, and my goal is to never have anything to do with them because I hate football. Sorry, but it's a bad sport, and neurologists should not watch it because we're supporting a bad sport. Do you know what the odds are of getting Parkinson's disease if you had a concussion with loss of consciousness? Concussion with loss of consciousness, odds ratio of 10, okay? Lifetime risk of Parkinson's disease, 2%. Just the back of the napkin calculations, that means if you have had a concussion, you've lived long enough, you've got a 1 in 5 likelihood of developing Parkinson's disease. What's the likelihood of getting Alzheimer's if you've had a concussion? Forget CTE. I don't care about CTE. It doesn't exist. Only Ben and Amalu and my partner Julian Bales thinks it exists. Let's say CTE doesn't exist. Alzheimer's exists. If you have a concussion, what's your risk of getting Alzheimer's? Doubled. Okay. What's a woman's lifetime risk for getting Alzheimer's? 1 in 5. You double that, that's not looking very good. What's a male's lifetime risk of getting Alzheimer's? 1 in 10. You double that, that's not looking very good. If I told you there's a 1 in 5 chance of dying if you go out of that door, I bet we're all going out of that door today. Okay. So concussion's an important factor. We ask about concussion. We ask how many you've had in your life. We can even document in what years so we can kind of get at, is there reverse causation? Is concussion preceding the onset of Parkinson's or occurring after the onset of Parkinson's? Have you ever had a head injury where you received medical attention? That kind of gets at the severity of the injury. We do a time test, the 9-hole peg test. We do that with the right hand and the left hand. That's not too exciting, but I'll just kind of show you what the fields look like. We document that. And then the nurse comes in. And that, by the way, takes 15 minutes for the MA. And in our practice, that's a good use of an MA's time. Then the nurse comes in, and for some projects we use a nurse, but for others we don't. And we can't use the MMSE because it's a bad test anyway. It has a ceiling effect, and it's copyrighted with a license fee. We can't use the MoCA in the EMR because, sorry folks, but they're not allowing it. You know, so if you're using it, God bless you, but you don't have their permission. So we're using something that Joe might remember called the short test of mental status, the old Kochman short test of mental status. And we've built it discreetly. I'll just show you some of the cool features. You can accordion open or close the instructions in case you don't remember how to do it. So it's very didactic for residents and fellows. You basically kind of come through these dichotomous variables here. And then if you don't complete everything, you don't get a subscore. If you complete it, it adds it up perfectly every time. Give you the digit span to remember. I'm going to give you up to 4 trials to learn 4 words. Let's say in the first trial, you got 3 words. Okay, second trial, you got 4 words. It took you 2 trials. It subtracts 1 for the number of trials. We'll do the calculations here. Okay, it again calculates the subscore. We'll do some abstractions here. It's not too different from the MoCA. It actually has the same construction items as the MoCA. The clock drawing gets you 2 points if you do it correctly with the hands. The cube drawing gets you a point. We ask about some information, define an island. It's not a place where you buy suntan lotion. And then can you remember the 4 words? And if you get everything correct, you get a green bar, and it even tells you the normal limits within 30 to 38. If you get a few things wrong, you get a red bar, and it immediately gives you a visual cue that your patient's cognitively impaired. What happens if you didn't do something correctly? Let's say that you did only 3 words in 2 trials. That's an invalid response. You get a yellow bar. You did something wrong. Go back and do it again. Okay. So this is a way of collecting information easily, teaching students how to do it well, etc. We do the geriatric depression scale. It auto scores and auto interprets like the STMS. I won't show it. We do the Epworth sleepiness scale because it's a common problem in Parkinson patients, especially on dopaminergics. It auto scores. I slept 4 hours last night, so let's see how I'm doing today. I'm sleepy. Not good. Not good for lecturing. Now, doctors will never be happy if they can't say, this delightful 48-year-old woman brought me brownies and argued with her husband for 58 minutes. Okay, so we can, you know, we could write there. You can dot phrase in your favorite little dot phrases if you want. You could even dot phrase in War and Peace if someone typed it for you, okay? And believe me, everyone reads your narratives, everyone, okay? So you could put all that non-discrete stuff in if you want, okay? Then we've customized the history because the neurologists who take care of Parkinson patients really don't care about cholecystectomies. What we care about are secondary causes of Parkinsonism. So we can basically ask about brain tumors and meningitis encephalitis, migraine is a comorbidity, MS, neuropathy, those are atypical features, et cetera. And let's just say that the patient was no for all of these things. They're perfectly healthy. You could say set unanswered to no, and it very quickly sets unanswered to no. We've also, as you can see, I haven't completely divorced myself from my prior life of genetics. We can take really, really good family histories, family history of Parkinson's in the family, let's say, yeah, my dad, family history of tremor, let's say, yeah, my paternal grandfather, family history of MSA, no, PSP, no, corticobasal, no, dementia, let's say, my dad, family history of ALS, no, stroke, et cetera. These are all things that are comorbid or aggregate within families of Parkinson's disease for people like me who used to study those sorts of things. And then if you want to add relatives, you can easily do that from this drop-down menu. You can also annotate whether they're alive or dead very easily. And then we come to the history of present illness. And we ask, in what year did your symptoms begin? Let's say in 2014. And we ask, were they motor or non-motor? And let's say they were motor. And then we can document what the initial symptoms were. And if I clicked rest tremor, it'll ask, was it more on the right side or the left side? Let's say on the right side. Where was it located? Let's say in the right foot. How about the bradykinesia? It was more on the right side. And then we could ask about prior diagnosis. When were you diagnosed? Let's say a neurologist in another practice diagnosed me in 2015. And you can even, if you want, put down their name. And every field has a comment box, so you can write as much discrete gobbledygook as you want. Okay? So you don't. It's not an either or. Discreteness doesn't mean you can't put color commentary into your note. We then ask about current symptoms. Which of these symptoms do you currently have? By the way, if you use this tool, you will be 100% compliant on 100% of your patients when you submit them to Axon Registry, and then your marketing team can say University of Cincinnati Department of Neurology is 100% compliant on AAN quality measures compared to Ohio State, which is 10% compliant, and you kind of can see where that can be a little fun for a marketing team. But, you know, if you don't have tools that make sure that you're compliant, you're as bad as everybody else. And then we have all the non-motor symptoms here that they care about and the course of the symptoms. We ask about brain imaging because, of course, radiologists don't document brain imaging features discreetly. So let's say I had an MRI in 2015 and it was normal. Let's say I had a DAT scan also in 2015 and I had reduced uptake in the left striatum. So we can document that discreetly. We can document your current symptoms, or treatments. Now, in EPIC today, you know what drug a patient's on, but you don't know how it's working. You don't know if it has side effects. Isn't that kind of what you want to know as a doctor? Not, you know, just are they taking it or not? That's all EPIC cares about, are they taking it? So carbidopa levodopa, let's say that they're taking it. Has it improved them or not? Let's say minimal improvement. Oh, maybe I should push the dose. Is it causing side effects? It's causing nausea. Oh, maybe I better take care of that before I push the dose. Any antidopaminergics that might be causing secondary Parkinsonism? Let's say, yeah, the patient's on lithium. Have they ever had surgery for Parkinson's? And we'll come back to that. Let's say, yes, they had DBS. They had left STN, let's say. And let's say they had bilateral. And they did it at 2015 at a private practice that does only DBS for Parkinson's disease. Physical therapy in the last year, no. Occupational therapy or speech, no. Prior treatments, my least favorite drug in the world, risagiline. The people who made this should be flogged. You know, $10 a pill that does nothing. Is it effective? No, of course not. Does it cause side effects? Usually not. And why did the patient stop it? Because of lack of efficacy and cost, almost certainly. Okay. So now we've collected all that historical information. We can examine the patient. So here's the UPRS, and we've built all six components of the UPRS, which is the standard workhorse of doing Parkinson's research. And in case you don't know what it is, because you're a resident, you can hover over these variables, and by hovering, it defines the variables. So I'm not going to click on this because it's just going to add up to a score between 0 and 108. But it's really cool because these 27 items are defined, and you never have to worry about what the definition is if you take the time to read the tool. Steps to turn a full circle, and we could mark that. And then all the other UPR scores tools are the same way. You hover here, it defines the variable for you. We actually have the patients fill it out on paper ahead of time, and then somebody enters it in for us. You can also send it out to patients by MyChart if you have a long wait list, but we'd like to see our patients within 2 weeks, and usually within 2 weeks, patients aren't very compliant in returning information. Yes, Joe?
Yeah, three questions.
Yes, sir. I'm glad we talked before the meeting and you asked the question I asked you. Yes. No, all kidding aside, that's a great question, and the answer is yes. So there's a button here called Last Filed, and what if you activate that for every field, it will show you when you used it last, who used it, the date and time that they used it, and what they put down. And if you just click, if nothing's changed, you can just click on that little footnote, and it'll repopulate the form. The other thing that you could do is you could do a copy forward, and you could copy forward the whole module from a previous note. You choose which note you want to do it for, or you could even copy forward the whole note. Not a good idea. That's called fraud. But all of those features exist. Another real cool feature is which I'll show you the slides when we get back to them, if we get back to them, is the summary. So let me show you what happens as a result of all this clicking. Let me come back, and I'm going to I can't do all the presentation, so I apologize. But so for one thing, you know, we get this alert, so the patient's eligible for the DNA project. This is what the doctor sees, and then this is what the MA sees in the back end. This is kind of what you were asking about, Joe. This is a dashboard, and for every time I open up an encounter for the patient, I can see every time they had any of these score tests done before, what was their score at that date versus today's date. The patients love it. In fact, I turn the screen and we look at it. And then if you want to get granular and see why things change, you can even look per item from date to date to date to see what's changing. So that's another cool feature that we've built. Just in case you want to know what the final product looks like, in case all you, I don't care about quality. I don't care about research. I just want to get paid, you know, for the hard work I do. So, and I have to have a good note. So this is the letter that gets generated. When I shake hands with the patient, pharmacy has the prescriptions. The referring doctor already has the letter auto-faxed to them. And I'm handing to the patient an after-visit summary that includes my letter to the doctor and my 10-page progress note. And I use that to educate the patient, all in 60 minutes. Okay? So this is what the letterhead looks like, to whom it may concern. It pulls in the patient's name, Mayo Clinic style. It bookmarks the diagnosis. It bookmarks the impression and the plan. Now, our neurologists want to type the impression. Some teams have made even that discreet. But for Parkinson's, we like to type the little bit of impression. The plan, we use dot phrases, because none of us could agree on standardizing how to give carbidopa-levodopa. Pretty stupid. But other groups have made little buttons, and you can standardize the plan, too. We've done that for our brain health cohort. But everything you see here took me 5 minutes maximum to generate, the impression, the plan, my auto signature. And here's what the progress note looks like. Nice label. We'll put University of Cincinnati here. We'll use the red colors. Demographics get pulled in, reason for coming, history of present illness, the gobbledygook you typed, initial symptoms in a table, current symptoms in a table, non-motor symptoms, course of symptoms, prior diagnosis, imaging, prior medical treatments, current treatments, allergies, meds, past medical history, family history, social history, all of the risk factors, the review systems, The MoCA, this was when we were using the MoCA. I have to upgrade the slides. Now we use the STMS line per line. You couldn't possibly type or dictate this. The geriatric depression scale, the Epworth sleepiness scale, the nine-hole peg test, the UPRS motor, the all of the other UPRS, the exam, the impression and plan. Now, I work in Chicago. There's five medical schools. We've got Northwestern breathing down our neck. We got, you know, Rush breathing down our neck. And we're just a little community-based health system. But when the referring doctors see the notes from Northwestern and Rush, they're using Epic, and they look like the same, you know, type notes that you guys are probably generating. You really can't see much difference between anybody else. But when doctors see these notes, they say, what's going on at North Shore? They're doing something up there. So these are very differentiating, I can assure you. Okay. I don't think I can show you too much more. When do you want me to stop? Now? Okay, so I'll just show you that, you know, we're capturing hundreds of fields of data. These are what the reports look like. Our annual follow-up rates are nearly 90% over 5 years. What are your follow-up rates? I bet you don't know. I know. We've used these tools 12,000 times. No one quit yet. We have 97% participation in research. This is what a data quality report looks like. This is a descriptive cohort report. I won't show you what the HTML looks like. You know, we have two aims. One is to do an NPBRN and share tools and data. One is to do pragmatic trials using the EMR. These are some examples of QI. Here's a best practice alert. These are the sites. Together, we will see about 1 million distinct patients in 5 years. That's a lot more than the 200,000 distinct patients I could see at my organization only. So we'll learn faster. That's how we import tools and export data. These are all the pragmatic trials that we're doing in the next 4 years using the EMR. They're all good ones. We don't have answers for any of these. And if you don't think this is important, you're right, it isn't. But I was really pleased when this issue of Neurology Today, they had the best advances of 2015, picks from the Neurology Today editorial board. And this guy, the number one cited best pick, was our paper. And he said, all neurologists should study their project and consider whether and how to work with their medical informatics experts to exploit the potential of their EMR to further practice improvement, blah, blah, blah. Well, don't take it from him. Take it from this guy. Data should be democratized. They need to be of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's what we're trying to do through the EMR, through this initiative. Thank you. Sorry we ran late, but I'm here until 4 p.m. Yes?
So could you maybe just say a quick word about the Axon registry so people are aware?
Sure.
Jim approached us about this. Actually, we put the grant in for HRP that got funded. We simply couldn't turn it on in time. We considered it, but we didn't. It's a lot to bet. It's a complicated system. Congratulations on putting it together. It's really impressive. It's something that is still a possibility and something that perhaps we'll continue to talk about going forward. The Axon registry is an AAM product that Jim knows more about than me.
Yeah. That is the biggest hurdle in many respects. Well, I'm on the committee, so I'm on the AAN registry committee, and what we've been working on for the last year is, first of all, deciding what are the common data elements that we want to collect. Most of the things that we think we can collect are process measures, so they're not outcome measures, and they're not independent variables. So it's like, if the patient had Parkinson's, was a discussion about advanced care planning documented? If the patient has Parkinson's, was a discussion of was there some mention of depression? It doesn't matter how you measured it, what you did about it, but you just have to put the D word somewhere in your chart, and you get a tick. You know, you get a check mark. So they're very crude process measures, but what basically this FIGMD software does is it's spyware that takes a snapshot of your EMR. So frankly, I'm surprised that a place like the University of Cincinnati would have approved it, because you're letting somebody take a snapshot of your EMR with all the identifiers. I just saw famous football player of the Cincinnati Bengals who came to see me because he has memory complaints. Okay, and somebody in India who's going to be abstracting this, that's where most of it is going to look at this and say, wow, I could keep getting paid, you know, $5 an hour to abstract charts and put them into the form, or I could call Entertainment Tonight and tell them that the famous quarterback has CTE and get paid $200,000. So most organizations are actually reluctant to participate, and this has been a barrier to participation in the activity, because they don't want that identifying information going out of the health system, even if it's to a contracted third party with a good reputation. And these people are phenomenal. Okay, so what some of us are doing, and we're participating in the registry, is so those are pull sites. Don't burden my doctors. Photograph the chart, do it with it whatever you want, and just help us get paid more. Okay, that's approach number one. Approach number two is, no, we're going to give you information. We're going to be sure that you always code it properly. What we are finding is that the people who are in the pull, they're getting these reports back, and the doctors are blowing steam through their ears because they're saying, what are you talking about? I didn't document this, that, or the other. You didn't know where to look. And so they're spending a lot of time now in the back end figuring out why the doctors are being told only 10% you were compliant on this, when the doctor feels they're 100%, and they're remapping and so forth. So a lot of effort goes into mapping. So I think that these are not either ors. I think this is an and. It's an opportunity for you to hardwire quality and safety at the point of care. It's an opportunity for you to get much better reports, much more granular reports that your clinician researchers can use. And it's an opportunity for you to push out data that will be 100% accurate, because it was collected in an 100% accurate way. And not only will you get paid, but you'll be able to differentiate, because you'll be able to show that you are doing better than your peers who aren't using structure. So I think they are complementary. Thank you very much. Actually, I'm going to give another presentation, right? Yeah. Yeah, I am.
I just need the
8
to 9 presentation.
No, 9 to 10 is for resident. Okay. So you need my presentation.